south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
Let's see now. The last show, I left off talking about expat Eddie, didn't I? I mentioned he's been buying up things, knowing that the U.S. dollar is, you know, a ticket to nowhere. A guaranteed losing proposition. Anyway, he's been picking up a few pieces of land and houses from desperate sellers. He bought a beach house in a very nice residential beach area. You know, everyone's got their own backyard connected directly to the beach. I'd stay at the strip where the wealthy people are, like Eddie. It's probably a mile long. And as you might think, because it's a bunch of rich people with beach houses, the water and the sand that you see when you walk out your back door, right on the beach area there, is pristine. Not a bottle cap, cigarette butt, or a McDonald's wrapper in sight. There's really not a single eyesore up and down that whole strip, in fact. And that's because everyone's got his own gardener, and they're out there every day getting rid of the odd clumps of seaweed that wash up. Some of those guys even rake the sand so that it doesn't look like it's ever been walked on. And when you walk on it and come back an hour or two later, you can't even locate your own footprints because they're gone. They've been raked. Now, that's not to say some of the big houses and mansions aren't a little bit run down in the area. People got money, all right. You can tell by their cars. But, you know, this is Latin America, and the word maintenance really does not exist. And some of the pools, man, from a distance, they look great, but I wouldn't go in half of them. Again, because of the maintenance, some of them are pretty murky looking, but mostly because of the pee. You know about the pee, right? So what has that got to do with anything? Well, I'm getting there. Be patient. Now, you see, every time there's an upscale beachfront community, very nearby is a small little town. Some of them really small, one-horse towns without even a streetlight, and just one main drag. And the nearby little town, by Eddie's beach strip, it's a place where locals live and hang out, and where the people with the very nice houses come in to stock up on things at the mini-mart and hang when they're bored. A couple of little bars and cantinas, a few restaurants. Typical laid-back little beach town, mostly poor and middle-class locals, with a smattering of wealthy people with beach houses popping in and out for supplies. Now, that little beach town near Eddie's place, and all the little beach towns throughout Latin America, have their own scruffy little public beach, too, where the locals have their little picnics, and the kids splash around, bring their animals, stray dogs, seagulls. You even see the occasional pig walking around. Yep, real-life pigs, dipping their hooves and refreshing themselves in the water. You know, porkers, and not just a few of the human kind, too. And you know, up and down the Caribbean and Pacific coast, there are hundreds of little beach towns like that. No real industry, just a few bars, restaurants, gas station, a variety store or two, and a handful of cheap hostels and hotels. Definitely too small to support a McDonald's or Kentucky Fried. And those beachfront hostels, there's always a hostel or two, which tend to draw low-budget European and gringo backpackers who don't or can't spend 100 to 200 bucks a night in a real 3 or 4-star beachfront hotel. But let me tell you, from my perspective, there's one big problem with all those little Latin American beach towns. The beach, the sand, and the water are filthy as and somehow the locals and the kids playing around there don't seem to notice. And no one lifts a finger to do anything about it. Except the odd European and gringo expat, like Eddie. Now, Eddie, since he's living nearby that little town, pops in there all the time to have a beer or coconut water or hit the mini-mart. And the little kids know he's kind of a regular, so they all run up to his table at the little coffee shop. They came running up fast when we were there. And then Eddie buys him a Coke or gives him some loose change. Now, they're not poor beggars or anything. Sure, they're poor, but they're not begging. But they know Eddie, like most gringos, are soft touches for little kids. And that's not really good, you know, giving kids money and buying them Coca-Colas. Eddie knows that. But he's also doing a very good deed on the side. And he's not one to talk about it. He never lets on when he's doing a good deed. I only know about it because I saw it in action. If you ask me, he's helping the locals and the environment in ways the many first world do-gooders and church groups that pop in on occasion could never begin to match. And here's the setup. Eddie made a deal with a little restaurant owner in that beach town. He rented a dumpster and had it put in the restaurant parking lot. Cost him 50 bucks to rent that dumpster for a month. He went to Costco, known as Price Mart down here, and he bought 500 heavy-duty garbage bags. And I mean heavy-duty, not the cheap ones. That cost him another 50. He spread the word that for every trash bag filled to the brim with McDonald's wrappers, plastic cups and bottles, you know, litter strewn around the beach and in the water, he put out the word that anyone who showed up in the parking lot of the restaurant, the owner would give him 50 cents in the local funny money for each filled bag of garbage. And as mentioned, he rented the dumpster for a month, and in 2 days it was filled. In fact, Eddie said, within a week it was emptied 6 times, and that was it for the trash. No more trash on the entire beach after 1 week. And the bottle caps and plastic bottles and such that were floating in the water, as well as the plastic junk that had sunk to the bottom, the not-so-easy stuff to collect, well, at the end of the week, that was all gone too. And get this, on the other side of that little town is where the locals lived. You know how they say in the movies, on the wrong side of the tracks? And during the following week, all the little kids, there must have been 30 of them, combed through those little neighborhoods and the beachfront on the other side where gringos and expats fear to tread. Though, not because it's dangerous, it's just really scruffy and pretty miserable looking. Well, that little local poor neighborhood and adjacent beachfront got cleaned up in a hurry too. Total cost to Eddie? To clean up a beach in a little town and the neighborhood next to it? Around $300. Plus, it gave the little local kids something to do that was constructive, was a definite visual improvement, and put coins in their pocket too. The question is, why didn't all those do-gooders that come down here every season handing out freebies think of something so simple, cheap, and easy? Duh. That just goes to show you, huh? Oh, and by the way, Eddie's idea is the gift that keeps on giving. Because even though after that month was over and they hauled that rented dumpster away, Eddie kept the deal going with the restaurant owner to accept bags of trash at 50 cents apiece in the local funny money. And since the big volumes of trash were already picked up, the little restaurant owner can easily handle a couple extra bags of plastic garbage a week in his own trash pile. It's funny, you know, people send me emails all the time saying, Johnny, how can we help the locals without causing some of the typical problems the do-gooders cause? Like the fact that if you hand out too many freebies, people get used to handouts. Well, I can't think of a better idea than Expat Eddie's pay-for-play garbage beachcomber idea. Everyone who's seen it agrees it's been a great success, a win-win for everyone. All that impact in so many ways for just $300, too. Oh, and by the way, the secondary effect is that all the kids around the beach have an eagle eye out now for garbage. When they see some, they practically fight over it. How crazy is that? It's basically an extension of the old aluminum can recycling thing. Funny, here in Latin America, you never see aluminum cans tossed around because they've got recycling value. But man, down here, everywhere you look, you see boatloads of plastic bottles and bags. Now, Eddie's really low profile. He's not one to take credit for anything, and he'll be the first to admit it wasn't his original idea. He read about or saw on the internet somewhere, some gringo living in a beach area in Indonesia did it first. Anyway, if you know of a better idea that helps out not only the locals, but the environment too, I'd like to hear about it. Think about it. It's a triple whammy. You instill basic values into the locals, like don't litter, allow kids who've got nothing to earn a little money, as well as give them something constructive to do, and help the environment all at the same time. Meanwhile, at that little beach town, we were sitting in that little cafe, and a tour bus full of gringo church do-gooders pulled up. Funny how they all kind of seem to have come out of a sci-fi Invasion of the Clones movie. Oh, but there's more. And the first thing that happened, well, the local kids ran up right away. They recognized them as do-gooders bearing gifts. And they weren't wrong. The first thing they did was hand out free t-shirts with Jesus slogans on them. Yep, they say life is hard. And it's even harder if you're stupid. But the kids, they're not stupid. They can spot a gift horse a mile away. But the do-gooders get something out of it too. They get that do-gooder feel-good serotonin rush. And when they get back home, all happy and smiling with that do-gooder glow, they all congratulate each other. They've once again rescued, if only temporarily, some of the unfortunate dregs of society. Meanwhile, after a couple of weeks, things with the locals slip right back the way they used to be. But those do-gooders did get their photo ops, and they've got a tale to tell at the next Michael Rowed the Boat Ashore, Hallelujah, church event. I say double kumbaya to you too, bro. By the way, there will be more Expat Eddie stories coming at you. But first, another email from the land down under. Been getting quite a few of those lately since, as you probably know, Australia has been under the strictest of lockdown situations, more in some ways than even China. I think George Orwell, even Chairman Mao, would be proud. Anyway, this is from Ben, down under. He says, G'day, Johnny. Hope you're well, mate. Of course you are. You're in Latin America. He says, I meant to write when you made some comments about Australia a few weeks ago. Funny thing, I've always had an interest in living part-time in Latin America, purely because I love the place. However, I've always found the Plan B concept, getting out of Dodge permanently and all that, a bizarre one, that is, until recently. Though I understand things aren't great and are getting worse up where you come from, the States. But I'm sad to say it's an absolute political shitstorm where I am down under. You were right, Johnny, when you said what harsh restrictions we are under. But it's actually only the two most populous states here, New South Wales and Victoria. Where I am here in Melbourne, the capital of Victoria, it's the worst by a long shot. Did you know that every person who can work has now got to be vaccinated by the 15th of this month? We are now officially the most locked down city in the world. I personally can no longer work without sneaking around because I haven't stupidly stuck my arm out for them. Our international borders have been closed shut for 18 months, too. All this despite a national total of only 1,600 odd COVID deaths since this crap started. The good news is the flu has ceased to exist completely. It's gone, just like that. Not sure where it went, but apparently it couldn't coexist with its far more deadly rival. Did they duke it out on a microscopic level and COVID won? By a knockout? We'll have to ask the all-knowing, the all-powerful Oz behind the curtain, Dr. Falsey. That wasn't Ben, that was me, Johnny, throwing that Dr. Falsey crap in there. Hey, if the shoe fits, right? Anyway, Ben goes on to say, I know how you feel about politicians, Johnny, and here in Victoria, I think now, officially, we have the absolute worst of the worst. Daniel Andrews is his name. This absolute shit for brains makes Biden look like Einstein. Guaranteed, he says, if this 24-carat dickhead was a so-called leader in Latin America, his head would certainly no longer be joined to the rest of his body. Oh, and if your listeners, Johnny, would like a photo of him for target practice, no problem, I'll send you some pics. All right, enough of that, Johnny. I think you know how I feel. Now for a question. And this is absolute plan Z for me. I have a vague memory of you talking about how ivermectin can help get rid of those bad after effects, the sequela, if you happen to decide to get jabbed and join the herd. Can you please send me that info? Signed, Ben from Down Under. Yeah, Ben, thanks for that, and sure thing, I'll send you that stuff. You know, there's been lots of new research coming out saying that down the line when those unknown secondary effects do kick in, a tiny maintenance dose of ivermectin can attenuate those symptoms. After all, that's what we're all really worried about, right? Those unintended secondary effects that could kick in weeks, months, even years after you had the jab. By the way, I've been reading some articles, some scientific white papers, peer-reviewed research reports coming out of various countries saying people who are on a prophylactic dose of ivermectin, well, let's not call it prophylactic because that paints a certain image in people's minds. Let's call it a maintenance dose. Get this, taken just once a week or even once a month pretty much protects a person from ever getting nailed by a COVIDiot strain. And believe me, it's the tiniest of ivermectin doses too. In fact, I just got done reading a study that said all you need is 3 milligrams. That, I believe, is the smallest dose you can get. If you take just one of those pills once a week or even once a month, they're saying, protected against COVID and the variants. In addition, there are many, many new peer-reviewed studies coming out saying, as Ben mentioned, ivermectin offers a certain amount of protection even if you've been a guinea pig and have taken the experimental vax and are now experiencing some of the more well-known secondary effects, all of which are pretty disturbing and pretty damn scary. By the way, I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I had all the early childhood vaxes against my will because I was a child. Same with you. That is, all except polio. Back in my grade school days, it came in a sugar cube, 3 different doses, 3 different days. Well, the sugar cubes were infused with polio vax, so they were yellow, and it looked pretty awful. So I gave mine to the fat kid, Roger Miner, who would eat anything. In fact, he was the lunch plate scavenger all through grade school. And I remember there were a couple other kids who gave Roger their yellow-tinted polio sugar cubes, too. I kind of wonder what happened to Roger. If he's got any kids, and if they have the right number of fingers and toes, if you know what I mean. But like I said, I'm no anti-vaxxer. Just show me a vax that's safe and effective and has been tested on animals the requisite amount of time, 4 or 5 years. A vax that's been tested independently, not evaluated by a lab that's funded or gets grants from Big Pharma. Show me a vax with risks, they all have risks, you know, that are minor and cause no permanent damage. Then sign me up, I'll get the vax. But unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case for most of all the vaxes out there. Especially those COVIDiot vaxes. All right, now a couple of quick emails regarding last week's show, talking about EMF readings and dirty electricity. Again, I firmly believe everyone should have access to a good EMF meter. There are lots of bad ones out there. The thing is, you're not going to get a good one for under $100. Yeah, I know. It's a pretty big investment, even $100, if you're going to use the thing only very infrequently. I probably only whip mine out about twice a year and use it for maybe 10 minutes. So maybe think about if you've got some like-minded, intelligent friends that live nearby, maybe you can just co-op it between 2 or 3 or 4 people, you know, split the cost. And it's worthwhile repeating, I have a really nice EMF meter, cost me something like $110. And the thing is, it's so intelligent, you don't really have to know anything about it or what the numbers mean. It measures 3 different kinds of dirty electricity, and in the audio mode, it beeps when readings are out of the normal range. You don't have to know anything else. And of course, it displays exact measurements on the screen, which is split into 3. One for each of the 3 electric power scales. And when you're looking at the screen at the 3 different readings, it's idiot-proof too because it flashes the word normal, medium, or high. High meaning, of course, back off, it's excessive. In other words, you don't have to be a nerd or a geek or an engineer to understand which pieces of electronics you must keep your distance from. And the nice thing about the audio function is that you know immediately how far you got to get away from a dirty piece of equipment by just backing off until the sound stops, then you're in a safe range. Oh, and by the way, you guys and gals out there with smart meters, when you're checking dirty voltage with your EMF meter, you'll see you can put it right up to your smart meter and most times it'll read absolutely nothing. Totally safe. Don't let that fool you. Because you see, those smart meters send out some very dirty signals, but only intermittently. Typically, electrical and gas smart meters, yep, they've got gas smart meters now too. They send out their bursts of data that last a fraction of a second or more at intervals of every couple of minutes or a couple times an hour, depending on the make and model. That means they're only really spewing out dirty electricity less than 1% of the time. But still, when they do, it's not good. So if you're up close with your EMF meter in front of the thing, you gotta stay there for 5 or 10 minutes, or you won't catch those spikes. And even though your smart meter will send out very short bursts of dirty energy, lasting much less than a second, a good smart meter, like the one I recommend, has a peak capture function. It'll capture and show those pulses, lock them in and display them, no matter how short and intermittent they are. So if you are checking your smart meter, do stay there a while and wait for that pulse. Now, of course, in some states, countries, and jurisdictions, you can petition to get rid of that smart meter and go back to the old analog one. Do go retro if you can. Though if you're having a hard time getting them to come and remove it, you can buy a meter cover that looks like a steel mesh, made out of a metal, heavy-duty, stainless steel window screen material. Fits right over the meter, locks in with a clip, and blocks basically 90% or more of those dirty EMF spurts. They do work, but they're around $50 or so. And if you want to know a good proven source to get one of those, send me an email, theexpertfiles@gmail.com. And on that note comes an email from Cynthia. She says, I don't use my microwave oven to cook, but I use it for the timer function. Is it still producing dirty electricity then? Should I be worried? All right, me, Johnny here. Well, Cyn, if it's got a separate function for just a timer, and the magnetron, the heart of the unit, and the turntable doesn't spin, in other words, you don't hear that big clunk as it kicks in, then no, it's not producing dirty electricity. So it depends on your microwave, whether you can use the timer independently, apart from turning the entire unit on. By the way, it's a bad idea to run your microwave with nothing in it. The magnetron, which powers the unit, will eventually overheat and burn out. Not a good idea. Though I guess everyone who's got a microwave has done that at one time or another. I know I have. And we're all guilty of frying a little metal in our microwaves too, aren't we? By the way, the magnetron, or the power head of the unit, used to be called a klystron tube. What a name. It sounds like a technical term from a bad sci-fi movie, huh? Shades of Plan 9 from Outer Space, huh? A klystron tube. K-L-Y-S-T-R-O-N. Go ahead, look it up. Oh, and one more thing to clarify about the last Expat Files show. When we were talking about stainless steel and the use of it here in Latin America, it should be used as often as possible. You remember that advice, don't you? Now, I've noticed lots of gringos and expats. When they buy a new or even a used but in great shape beach house, it'll be equipped with painted galvanized steel or plastic gutters. Just a little tip here. Galvanized steel gutters work really well, and they last a long time, unless you're within a kilometer, that's 3/4 of a mile, from the ocean. Even if you don't notice it, there will be salt in the air that far inland, and that'll eat and corrode your galvanized gutters within about 5 years. They'll start looking pretty cruddy, too. That's why with most new construction, people are using those universal PVC white plastic gutters. Go ahead, use those instead of galvanized, but get the thickest, heaviest grade plastic you can because the rainy season is harsh and unlike anything you've seen up in the States. And if you have standard, kind of light gauge plastic gutters, they're just not going to hold up well in torrential rains. Just the sheer mass and weight of the water will flex and deform them in time. Sometimes the weight of the rain will pull your gutters away from the house. So you should use heavy-duty, not standard screws and fasteners. Now, you could use stainless steel gutters. They're about 5 times as expensive as galvanized or plastic ones. But they're solid as can be and will last a lifetime. But because of the high price, they're overkill for practically everyone. Though, you'll see them in commercial construction sometimes because those buildings, the commercial ones, are built to a higher standard. And no one wants to replace gutters in 5 to 7 years, especially in high-rise towers, churches, and hospitals. Oh, and one last thing about stainless steel I forgot to mention last time. Some people think that stainless steel is non-magnetic. Some people think a quick way to tell if it's really stainless steel or a stainless steel of a good quality, you run a magnet past it, and if it doesn't attract, doesn't stick, it's the real deal. But that's not necessarily true. Now, because stainless steel has steel in it, steel is made of iron and iron is magnetic, within the stainless steel alloy, there's always a ferric or iron phase, and that part's magnetic. Now, remember in the last show, I mentioned that there are 150 kinds of stainless steel, and some are not magnetic at all, and others are. For example, remember the DeLorean car they used in Back to the Future? Well, my buddy in Chicago has an exotic car dealership, and he's had DeLoreans. And once he showed me with a little magnet he had sewn into a glove that, yes, the all-stainless steel body of a DeLorean is slightly magnetic. Though, for example, 304 stainless steel is not magnetic in itself, but the magnetic properties of the machines used to cut and mill and turn out the bolts, screws, and washers during the production process will impart to a small degree magnetic properties. I'm sure you've seen that effect yourself when you're hammering a nail or tapping in a screw. They were neutral or unmagnetized out of the box, and suddenly they're sticking to the hammer or the screwdriver. I know what you're thinking. Too much information, Johnny. Stick to Latin America, please. Though I bet some of you are wondering why my buddy with the car dealership had a magnet stealthily sewn into his glove. Can you guess? It's because when he was doing a deal and someone brought a car in for a trade that looked in absolutely perfect condition, great paint job and everything, and the owner says, it's Cherry. It's got low mileage, only driven on weekends, never had an accident. Well, my buddy could put on that glove with the magnet in it, run his hand along the side panels and metal parts. With that magnet, he could tell right away if it had been in an accident and been repaired. A magnet would attract everywhere else except where Bondo or dent filler was used. Therefore, if it had been in a crash, even if it was a great repair job, cars of high value, especially exotic cars, lose some of their value. When they've been smashed and repaired, they're not considered pristine or Cherry anymore. Meanwhile, for all you listeners who think of the WHO, the World Health Organization, as the authority, the number one purveyor of righteous medical information and knowledge, and the last word on everything and anything to do with the COVID crisis, comes this article from the British wire service, Reuters. Turns out the World Health Organization Regional Director for Africa has said there's been an independent commission that found 21 out of 83 perpetrators of sex abuse in the Democratic Republic of Congo, they were WHO employees. Yep, we're talking about the honorable, esteemed WHO. And we're just talking about one country now. The World Health Organization is in 180 countries. The commission found that abuse, including 9 rapes, were committed by both national and international WHO staffers. Turns out this has been going on for ages. Hundreds of complaints had been filed, but the WHO never acted. Until now, an investigation published by the Thomson Reuters Foundation and the New Humanitarian Group, whatever that is, said that more than 50 women in just the Democratic Republic of Congo formally accused aid workers from the WHO and other leading charities of demanding sex in exchange for jobs during the 2018 through 2020 Ebola crisis. But typical of stagnant, corrupt, quasi-governmental organizations and many NGOs, the WHO said they will give a slap on the wrist and ban those identified as perpetrators from future employment with the WHO and terminate the contracts for people identified as perpetrators, those who were still employed by the agency when it was made aware of the allegations against them. Yeah, right. You just lose your job. You don't get prosecuted and go to jail. Typical, huh? But the even larger issue is the WHO, whose statistics and recommendations are adhered to by governments and quoted daily by lard bags like Bill Gates and lying pustulant sacks of dung like Dr. Fauci. Talk about hypocrisy and double standards. What you've got is the worldwide COVIDiot situation being managed by the WHO, an organization teeming with sexual predators and perverts. Isn't that nice? And finally, one more reason to go solar and get the hell off the grid. Turns out, throughout Puerto Rico, except in the ritzy-titsy districts of San Juan, where everyone's got a hospital-sized generator, electric power and transmission provided by the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority has been responsible in the last few months for power outages of 3 to 4 times a day. So lately, in most of Puerto Rico, people are without electricity for 6 to 8 hours a day. And the only solution for the private homeowner is to have their own generator. But with gasoline prices hovering between $3.50 and $4 a gallon, even people with generators are having a hard time filling up. It's just way too expensive, and generators are stinky and noisy, too. And remember, we're talking about a U.S. territory with 8-hour-a-day power outages. Isn't it about time to go solar and get the hell off the grid? Though that doesn't mean you have to disconnect from the grid completely. You should still maintain the meter hookup in case of emergency. Of course, that will mean, on average, you'll have to pay a $2 a month meter connection fee. Boo-hoo, huh? Hey, and don't think it's only happening here in Latin America. I noticed in the news, power outages and skyrocketing gas and electric prices are escalating everywhere up in the States, too. So there should be two things on your New Year's wish list. Number one, get the hell out of Dodge. Number two, go solar. In that order. It won't work the other way around. By the way, I'm recording this at a solar installation right now. At this place, they've got 29 440-watt solar panels and 2 Tesla Powerwalls. The place is 100% off the grid. Oh, and it supplies an electric car charging station, too. That means, in effect, the owner of this place is giving every utility company the finger. The owner tells me only sex feels better than that.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.